welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
It is better to be truthful and good than to not.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen, and not a one of you is prepared for it.
And they're sometimes joined by guests like...
This is Travis.
I had to stop her from screaming.
And Diane.
If you men only knew.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1998 film Primary Colors, directed by Mike Nichols and a screenplay by Elaine May. But first, housekeeping.
So, at your suggestion and high praise, I purchased on Blu-ray Children of Men and watched it.
Okay, I'm going to take it that you did not fall in love with it as much as I did.
I want my $12 back. So, okay. Let me say, first of all, the atmosphere of the movie was awesome. The visual of the movie, also awesome. I mean, it was immersive. The visuals were great. The dystopian future was great. The music was great. Cinematically, as a movie, great. Plot, not so much. And Kenny and I were talking about this. Maybe because I am not a parent and I don't have direct offspring, this movie doesn't quite hit the poignancy with me that maybe it does with you and Drew now as parents. It does, because this movie to me just fell very flat at points, and the story seemed lacking, and it just, there wasn't enough story to me, even though it was a fairly long movie. So it didn't resonate with me. The feeling of hope, I didn't get that from the movie, because I never felt the peril of the lack of future. And maybe that was me not fully embracing the dystopia and the fact that there was sterility and the death and the other continental conflicts. But it didn't do it for me. I understand that you and Drew loved it, but I just don't know how Drew got to, like, this is one of his top 10 movies. I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm just saying I don't get it. And that's why I after I watched it, you know, I listened to your podcast because I wanted to see maybe there was something that I didn't catch in my head, or maybe I missed a point, or there's a plot element that I just overlooked. But, I don't think so. I think it just didn't resonate with me. And I think that's why the movie didn't do as well, is because for a certain population of people, I just don't think the movie spoke to them, on a level that connected emotionally like it did with you. Clearly with you and Drew both, it was a very complete connection. So I lack that element that kind of tied it all in. Now, having said that, I mean, I watched the DVD, I watched the special features. You and Drew kind of touched on it, like in the scene where he's sitting in the booth with all the newspapers, and one of the production assistants was talking about how they had to go and create all those newspapers by hand. So she goes, we spent a couple weeks, you know, putting together nothing but newspaper articles that were in the universe that we had created. And so it took us a long time. So all those articles you see were part of the story, but we had to create those. They weren't just, you know, they weren't just dummied up. So if you were able to see them, they were real and true to the movie. There was a lot of continuous shots. The car scene where Julianne Moore is killed was like a 12-minute continuous shoot, which is kind of amazing.
Oh, yeah.
But her acting was terrible.
See, I didn't think she was in there long enough to be terrible. I thought that she was just fine.
She was terrible. I just thought her performance was terrible when she and when she's on the bus with him and he's interrogating her, like, I don't know how you could get over it. And she's like, you know, I can't look at you because you have his. It was just so, her acting was so bad. And I wanted to, you know, I wanted to like this movie because it is a gorgeous, gorgeous film. I mean, again, I will admit that it's a beautiful film and Michael Caine is great. But I just, it didn't, I don't know. The movie just didn't do it for me.
Yeah. I mean, obviously that's fair. I think because it wasn't the first time I had seen it. So I'd recommend you see it four more times and then judge, but,
four more times.
Well, conservatively. No, I'm kidding. You don't have to watch it ever again. Although if you, if
oh no, the, I mean, I'll watch it again. Cause I want to see, I mean, I'm sure I missed some things and I'm sure I will get things on the rewatch. And there was tension in the movie. I mean, there was some, you know, when they try and step through, the door and he gives, you know, she gives the baby to Mariska or whatever her name was. You know, I was like, oh God. And then when he killed the crazy guard guy, I've forgotten his name already, you know, beats him in the head with the battery that's just sitting there, the car battery. And I was like, ooh, wow.
Yeah, Sid.
Well, that's something.
Yeah, but
yeah, when he kills Sid.
I thought my favorite, although it's funny because in the clip that I pulled out of it, it's not quite, because you don't get the face he's making. His accent's kind of thick. So I don't know if it translates if you haven't seen the movie, but I love when he talks about, okay, you're Fuji's now. Make the Fuji face. Sad Fuji face.
Yeah, no. That's awesome. I mean, it was funny. And of course, he's talking about himself in the third person.
Yeah, is, well, and know. There's so many, like, because Michael Caine is usually, you know, it seems like he could be a comic relief character, but there's so many things in his little house that are expository, you know, just kind of like the newspapers in the bus shelter scene, that there's just a lot of subtlety going on.
And he reminds me, his character reminds me of somebody, and I kept thinking, I wrote down, Michael Caine reminds me of someone, but I can't place the character. But his character is great. But yeah, the quietest, you know, that made me laugh. So
I also thought that it was, again, I don't need to really defend it anymore because I had a whole podcast talking about it, but the fact that everything in the movie, you know, you're along on the ride with Clive Owen, and his world is sort of, he doesn't have any solid footing throughout this whole thing.
That's my dog's turn to bark. My dog's bark's a little more jarring than yours.
A little bit, yeah.
Griffin,
I thought it was successful in that way, but yeah, no, it didn't make a ton of money, and I like the way it ended because it ends in that hopeful yet kind of ambiguous ending too.
Yeah, no, it wasn't terrible. I mean, I didn't hate it. You know, it wasn't any Tiptoes, so
that's funny. Well, at least you didn't pay $12 for Tiptoes.
Oh, I'd have killed you.
I wondered if I had any housekeeping. I don't think I actually have any housekeeping. So are we ready to talk about Primary Colors?
We can start other than I wanted to say that Quietus just reminded me of Soylent Green, which you haven't seen, I don't think.
No, we'll have to watch it.
It's on the list.
Yeah, I've heard it's good. Oh, it's on the calendar probably, huh?
It is on the calendar. I went crazy.
Oh, I know you went crazy. I was there with all of my devices. We're just going crazy.
Now you know what it's like.
Primary Colors, 1998. So, Brother Jay, why are we watching Primary Colors?
Well, this is just one of those movies that I watched at the time. I'm pretty sure I saw it when it came out. And I was a pretty diehard, and still, I'm a big Bill Clinton supporter. You know, regardless of what you think of him, he had a pretty great presidency. So, and again, we may have another Clinton legacy presidency coming up. Maybe not, but we'll see. So, but this is one of those movies that I like because it's kind of a mix of emotions, because it's got a fair bit of some funny comedy, but also it's got a great deal of kind of dark drama to it too. So And being that it's kind of not so loosely veiled that it's really Bill Clinton in the movie, I just kind of am fascinated by it, especially because of how it just kind of came to be with the whole Joe Klein anonymous book.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting thing that, you know, I had remembered a little about, but doing research for the movie, it went, uncovering the anonymous author of the novel became sort of a thing. So much so that when Joe Klein, when they suggested that was the author, like several people suggested it, he denied it and denied it and denied it and denied it. And even Washington Post style editor David Vondrill, in an interview, asked him if he was willing to stake his journalistic credibility on his denial. And he did. He said yes. But then the Washington Post published results of a handwriting analysis of notes made on an early manuscript of the book. And after that, he admitted that he was anonymous. So that is crazy. I mean, that's a crazy amount of stuff. Of course, that was, you know, it was by the time the movie was made, it was already a known thing that he was the author of the novel. But then Elaine May, the writer of Heaven Can Wait, Ishtar, and The Birdcage, I believe she was nominated for an Academy Award for the screenplay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and Kathy Bates was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for her role, which I think was a deserved nomination.
Oh, she was great. I mean, as Libby, I mean, she was great.
Oh, yeah. I think most everybody did a good job.
Yeah, there was a lot of great performances in this. But the Kathy Bates Libby character was one of my more favorites just because she is totally off the rails, batshit crazy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as designed. But she is just a more extreme version of our main character, Henry. Because as Billy Bob Thornton points out, Henry's got a bad case of TB.
Yeah, the true believers.
Yeah, so, you know, that's why she's crazy, is she was a true believer. So, anyway. I'm going to agree with you ahead of time. The movie has really fun, except at the end of it, I was really kind of depressed. I mean, it really has a kind of a dark ending.
Yeah, no, the last quarter of the movie is nothing, just like a continuous punch to the balls downer.
Yeah. Yep. And, we'll get to the very end because I don't know if I like the very end. But we'll get there. So, we start off with young political idealist Henry Burton, played by Adrian Lester, who is approximately George Stephanopoulos, by the way.
Stephanopoulos, yes.
Sorry, George Stephanopoulos. And he is recruited to join the campaign of Jack Stanton, played by John Travolta, who is, for all intents and purposes, Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
And he's trying to win the Democratic Party nomination for President of the United States. And Henry's a little bit reluctant to join this team, although all the rest of his team believe it's a foregone conclusion he's going to join. But he is impressed by Stanton's genuine warmth and empathy with people. You know, he seems to be a good guy. And we meet Allison Janney, who is hilarious as a librarian/teacher.
Well, you open the movie, though. The movie opens with Handshake Instruction 101 with explaining, like, here's how you'll know where your status and where your purchase power comes with the governor based on how he shakes his hand with you and where he puts his other hand. And it's not about the handshake as much as it is where he puts his other hand, which is kind of a tongue-in-cheek reference anyway. But yeah, how about Allison Janney and how just crazy young she looked?
Evidently, she says that she was offered the role of C.J. Craig on The West Wing after Sorkin saw her as Miss Walsh in this film.
Well, that's awesome. And I hope that story is true.
Yeah. Well, either way, she is very funny and very smart and pretty much good in everything I've ever seen her in.
Yeah. I think Travis will agree that our most favorite C.J. Craig scene of all of West Wing is the Jackal. So,
okay. I don't get it, but hopefully Travis is laughing right now.
Have you not seen The West Wing?
Well, I haven't seen it continuously. I have our grandmother's copy. I will eventually get through, but, you know, time is precious.
Help me. Kathy, where's Sam?
In his office, fighting with your daughter.
Tell him to come to the press room. He's not going to want to miss the Jackal.
In Street Stride, they called him the Jackal. The Jackal.
A little speed bump with Jeff Breckenridge. Leo gave it to me because he thinks you're burned out on Mendoza. I told him I thought that was ridiculous. What do you think?
Are you talking to me during the Jackal?
I was just...
Never talk to me during the Jackal?
Sure. Black style,
diamonds in the back. Boards, white wall wheels, cruise control, built for speed, chrome on everything. And the stereophonic speaker, but he really didn't need them when they called him the Jackal.
Hey.
Hey.
Jackal.
So Mallory read my position paper on school vouchers.
Really?
Yeah.
I suppose she got a hold of that.
As it turns out, you gave it to her.
Mm. School vouchers are a very serious subject with Mallory.
Yeah, thanks for the heads up.
I don't mind you dating my only daughter, but you can't expect me not to have some fun along the way.
Mallory and I haven't actually been on a date yet.
Wow, you hang in there, son.
Living fast, living large, 6'4", not an ounce of fat. When women ask, is you a frown cat? He say, my dear, I'm more than that. I'm the frownest of the frown. And in case you hadn't known, they call me the Jackal. The Jackal.
So the rest of the inner circle consists of Stanton's wife, Susan Stanton, played by Emma Thompson, Hillary Clinton. And did you think her voice went in and out, her accent?
Yeah. Yes. Her accent was transient.
Yeah. I didn't like that.
But not unlike Dead Again.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, I thought she had the look right and the dialogue is right. She heard the accent just isn't quite what it should be.
Yeah. No, her accent kind of came and went and her accent was more notable when she was upset or playing overwrought.
Yes. So.
So the more upset she got, the more her accent was not her accent as much as it was Emma Thompson really being Emma Thompson.
Well, but Emma Thompson in Dead Again, her accent is really great compared to Kenneth Branagh's accent in that movie.
Scissors, scissors, scissors.
Yeah. So anyway, and then the aforementioned Howard Ferguson, played by Paul Guilfoyle, is the Harold Ickes. He's in the Wikipedia plot summary. He's called a sly political operator. And then we meet the spokeswoman, Daisy Green, Maura Tierney, who I love. And her real world opposite is either Mandy Grunwald or Dee Dee Myers. And then the ruthless redneck political strategist, Richard Jemmons, played by Billy Bob Thornton, is none other than James Carville.
Yeah.
In one of the, you know, one of the introductions to the James Carville character is when he asks the staffer if she wants to walk the snake.
What's this, Borgen?
What am I doing here? Does this guy even have a chance in hell?
I don't know. I haven't canvassed hell lately. But if we only worked for guys who had a chance in hell, we probably wouldn't have Richard Jemmons. Oh, shit, he's bird doggy.
Sweetheart, I got a hotel room over here. Why don't you go away with me for a little bit and show me?
You're crushing my originals.
Sorry, I didn't mean to do that.
You know what you're missing? It's got everything. It's got room service.
Wait.
Room vibrate.
Don't embarrass him.
Cable movies. You want to walk the snake? What's that look about? You don't believe me? Listen, baby, I'm telling you, I've got a python in here.
Hey.
Oh.
Gee, I've never seen one that old before.
Come on, bud. Let's park that Mustang back in the garage.
She's not married, is she?
Hey, fuck you!
Fuck me? Fuck you, you redneck son of a bitch!
Yo, fellas,
you ever hear of Anita Hill? Man, you are so lucky she's cool.
Well, hell, I wouldn't have done it if she wasn't cool.
Oh, and you know when a muffin is cool. Your sensitive mind tells you when it's time to show her your cock.
Henry. Where'd you go to school?
What?
Hotchkiss, right? I read up on you. You're a tight-ass, preppy elitist from Hotchkiss.
Oh, bullshit.
Bullshit, it's bullshit. You just called me a redneck, which I'm proud to say I am, and you, Hotchkiss, are a honky. You just look black, and it's the best part of you. Let you intimidate the pale face, especially lib labs. Work that voodoo sexual shit on white girls. Well, I'm probably blacker than you are. I got some slave in me. I can feel it.
You're crazy. You're
Henry.
Complete... What?
So terrible. Yeah, pretty sure he's got some slave in him.
Yeah. So that's pretty great. So, you know, we kind of get to know this team, and it's, you know, you're following the governor around, and he's just definitely a folksy people person. And it's obvious that he is the people person and his wife is the strategist or, like more ruthless political animal.
Yeah. And I will quote her. I'm going fly fishing with this guy, you asshole.
Oh yes. I love the introduction to her is she's throwing shit at him and calling him names.
Yeah, well, and like when they go back to the hotel, motel, office, wherever that, when he's all acting up and she chucks the keys at the back of his head. I mean, it's great.
So after the first debate performance against his Democratic rivals, Henry's ex-girlfriend shows up to question Stanton about his arrest during the 68 Democratic Convention in Chicago. And she works for, the Black Advocate, small newspaper. And the whole team gets worried that, well, if she found out this Democratic convention thing where he was arrested, but then used his political connections to get out of it, that other people are going to find out.
Yeah, it's really just a matter of time. If this small little paper was able to dig this up in just a short period of time, the bigger papers with better paid reporters who are more hungry and more eager to turn up trash are going to find it just as easily.
Yeah, and that's where... Billy Bob Thornton says, hey, we got to deal with the Clearwater problem, which is obviously Whitewater, and then the Chicago problem, and then also the woman problem.
Yeah.
And that's when Henry discovers that there is a woman problem. I mean, he already knew from Allison Janney.
Yeah, it was pretty obvious that there was some shenanigans. But to back up just a little bit, when he and Billy Bob Thornton are in the office and they're having the blacker than black and blacker than you conversation, you know, Henry utters the most uncomfortable line, I think, of the movie, where he's like, how do you know when the muffin is cool? And it's just cringe inducing.
It's funny, though. It's weird. But we have that in order to address all the problems, they have to know as much of the problems as they can. So they have to actually talk to the candidate, or in this case, they need to talk to the candidate's wife.
And they have a pretty comedic discussion over, you know, who do you talk to, the wife or him? And they have this big long debate, and then finally they're like, well, who? And they're all like, well, her.
Yeah, obviously him. So yeah. She and her best friend, confidant, go into this meeting with Maura Tierney, Billy Bob Thornton, and Henry. And they basically, Billy Bob Thornton's character is like, say you're in the woods taking a shit. And does this long thing, and it's so funny.
What's the crisis?
Say you're out in the woods taking a shit. And a wild boar comes charging at you. Now, do you pull your britches up and run? Or do you try to pull your britches up and grab the doves you just shot and then try to run, all at the same time? Or do you just forget about the fucking doves, pull your britches up and run because you ain't got time to aim and button your fly? And if you miss, well, you don't want to die with your dick hanging out. You see what I'm saying?
I think I speak for everyone in the room when I say no.
Well, I mean, what if you're not prepared for the boar? And you get caught with your britches down and lose the ducks?
All right, what Richard is saying is, if you get caught in the forest...
Oh, don't give us a taking a shit in the woods metaphor again. Tell us what you're talking about.
Okay. Say this boar is part of a pack of other boars.
Who do the boars represent? The Republicans?
No, the press.
The press?
Yes. Don't they?
Yeah, the press. Now, you're dealing with these wild boars.
Oh, God.
And suddenly they start saying things like marijuana. Chicago. Maybe a woman comes forward and
Bullshit.
Says something.
Bullshit. That's not going to happen.
Right.
Absolutely not.
Well, I don't think so either. But if it did happen, then he's not going to get trapped like Hart because we know the rules. If some bimbo from a former life comes forward, then we just say bullshit.
Bullshit is right. I don't even know why you're talking
about. What are you suggesting we do? How would you deal with it?
By knowing more than they do. By being prepared so that when a story like Chicago comes up, we can fight back with the truth.
That's impossible. How are we supposed to know what kind of garbage they're going to come up with?
Well, that's the point, Lucille. That's the whole ever-fucking point. We need to hire an operative to do research. You see what I mean? We need to get somebody that can get
investigate our lives.
Investigate everything. Everything anybody can make an allegation about.
Well, that's ridiculous. We don't play that game. That's the media's game. We play the people's game. We say to them, the Republicans and the media, that want the election to be about trash. We want it to be about your future. We don't shoot doves in this campaign, Richard. We protect them.
What do you mean?
Well, don't the doves represent the people?
No.
Well, then I don't understand who the doves are.
Forget the doves. Henry, you agree with this?
Yes.
Okay. We'll do it. I'll tell the governor. I want Libby Holden.
Oh, my God.
If we're going to get someone to dig around and find the dirt, we have to have someone who knows us, someone we trust completely.
But, I mean, look, is she at the hospital?
Yes.
And she's, you know, okay.
Who is she?
She was Jack's chief of staff 20 years ago. She had a breakdown.
I mean, she just suddenly became incoherent in the middle of a press conference. It's awful. I mean, she's been in and out of mental hospitals for years.
She seems very stable now. She's been back home for 18 months. You and Henry can fly back tomorrow and brief her.
Well, that's good. That she's stable. Because, you know, you're kind of putting the whole campaign in her hands now, you know.
Yes, I know.
Well, that's good.
Then are we the doves?
Lucille, I think we can forget the metaphor.
Actually, I think we're the ones taking the shit in the woods.
Hillary's friend is hysterical through the whole thing. So after they have this information, or they figure out what they really want, Susan says, yeah, we need to have somebody, you know, dig up what we need to dig up. And it has to be Libby Holden, played by Kathy Bates. And her real world opposite is either Betsy Wright, who I don't remember enough about the history of her, or Vince Foster. And I know plenty about the history of him because it ended shortly after the Clinton presidency, when he killed himself, supposedly.
Conspiracy theorists abound.
Yeah, because he was known to be a confidant of Hillary Clinton. So they hired Libby to respond to any attacks designed to undermine his candidacy and to anticipate problems. So that's what she's good at.
She's the dustbuster.
She is. All of her lines are great in this movie, even the more serious ones at the end. And this is the point in the movie where they're all arguing in the hotel room, and Bill Clinton, John Travolta, Jack Stanton, whoever we're going to call him, is actually at the Krispy Kreme that's sort of in the parking lot of the hotel or across the street.
Across the street, yeah.
There's this fantastic tracking shot from the hotel room window all the way down to the Krispy Kreme front door. And then Henry comes through the door. It's really a beautiful shot. I think I backed that up and watched it twice because it was just so
good. Yeah, it's really well done.
And that's where you get kind of an honest moment where Jack is just talking to the clerk at the Krispy Kreme who has what some he's like cerebral palsy, something, or maybe he's, I don't know,
some kind of learning disability.
Well, and also he's got like a leg issue.
Yeah.
So he's just basically like chewing the fat with the real person with real problems. And he's a guy who's actually interested in helping real people, which is one of his endearing traits. And even though you find out pretty quickly that a lot of his homespun stories are manufactured, still,
they're kind of make your own, choose your own adventure stories, because he kind of takes whatever elements are in the room and kind of incorporates them into the situation and the story.
He's kind of Kaiser Sose. So that's when we find out that one of Stanton's mistresses, Kashmir McLeod, played by Gia Carides from My Big Fat Greek Wedding, and she is, her real life counterpart is Jennifer Flowers. And her attorney produces a secret taped conversations between she and Jack to prove they had an affair. But as they're listening to this tape, Henry discovers that the tapes have been doctored. And, you know, this is the early days of cell phone where it was all analog cell phone traffic. So you could actually pick up somebody's cell phone signal and record it. And this is where we meet our trifecta of Larry King sightings.
I'm pretty sure, by the way, Larry King is going to end up, I don't know this, but I have a sneaking suspicion that Larry King is going to be in the next movie.
Well, we'll see. But before Larry King, though, Libby tracks down the man responsible for the tapes and forces him in a rather forceful and creative way to confess his guilt and sign a letter to the American public.
And she has a couple great lines here.
Yes, I'm goddamn sure I know who did it. Yes, I'll get it done. Okay, bye.
Wait a minute. You know who did it?
Yes. Oh, yes, indeedy.
A triumphant day, huh, Randy? Perhaps your best ever. Is that Kashmir on the line? Let me say hi.
No, it's not.
Well, say goodbye to Sherman Presley, then. We've got business.
It's not Sherman Presley, whoever he is.
Well, you branched out, Randy. Electronics now, huh?
I don't know what you're talking about.
You've been recording your friend the governor's private conversations, haven't you?
What? You? Come on, why would I do that? Look, I'm a big Stanton supporter. I always have been. Why, he's putting this state right on the map.
You know, I've only been here 20 seconds, and you've already exhausted my patience. I'm going to want a signed confession.
Put that thing away before you do something stupid and get yourself into trouble.
Randy, you wet fart of a human turd. You ambushed Jack Stanton, and you're going to admit it or you're going to die.
Libby, you're crazy!
Certifiably. At last, the fact.
Hey, buddy, you'll go to jail, too.
I don't know anything about this.
He's shocked. He had no idea. Now, Randy, you gonna write this out in longhand?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Enough. You know what? I'm gonna blow your nuts off. Yes, I'm a gay lesbian woman. I do not mythologize the male sexual organ.
God!
Now, you tiny scumbag. I know you did it. You're on retainer to the Flash, I know that. And you stupid little shit, you couldn't just make do with the crap Jack actually did. You had to embellish it. Well, mister, you're about to become Mrs.
Libby, come on, don't!
You have a choice to make, and very quickly. Just how crazy is Libby? And you're gonna have to do it now. One, two. Oh, this is gonna be fun.
Okay!
Very good, very wise. Now, I want you to be eloquent in this letter you're about to write, and guilt-ridden about your jealousy and greed. You could not live with yourself if you deprived the American people of this man.
Tonight, an aide of Governor Jack Stanton has asked to join us in order to play a tape.
And I was dying.
Well, I love it that without so much as, I mean, they didn't actually say it out loud, but the staffer that she immediately wants because she looks like Winona Ryder. And also, it's funny because Billy Bob Thornton's character calls every girl he falls in love with Winona Ryder. And she's the one that says that you're crushing my originals.
He just calls him Winona.
Yeah, well, And, you know, she's the one that he wants to see if she'll walk the snake. And she puts him down in that manner that we had a clip of earlier. But, you know, Libby wants her as her staff person. And it's very clear that they're more than just staff people. Like, she's moved in with Libby. So finding out that Libby is a lesbian is not surprising. So it's a movie with a lesbian relationship in 1998 that wasn't it wasn't sexy. It was just there. So that's fun.
Yeah, it was just a thing.
Yeah. So then there's another allegation that comes up, a much more serious one. This is where Stanton's old friend and cooker of barbecue, Big Willie McColson, played by Tommy Hollis, approaches Henry to tell him that his 17-year-old daughter, Loretta, who worked for the Stantons as a babysitter and who we've already seen Jack being very cold toward, she is pregnant and that Stanton is the father. So this is where Henry and Howard have to go tell Willie that he has to allow his daughter to undergo an amniocentesis to determine Stanton's paternity. And this is a serious mission that they are on, and Henry is sickened and disillusioned by the experience.
He's, you know, at first he is willingly led by the governor, who, you know, he confronts Governor Stanton and says, you know, am I doing this because I'm black? And the governor's like, of course not. You're doing this because Willie chose you. And you believe the governor's conviction in that point, but Henry, I don't think, from a character standpoint, ever believes it. Well, I think he continues to think throughout that the only reason he's there is because he's the black element.
True. And also he's there. I mean, he's there to strong arm Willie into being silent.
Yeah. Although he doesn't do much but try and smile and not throw up.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah,
you know,
I mean, they're there on pretty serious grounds. And the governor did look him in the eye and say that he's not the father all along, by the way. Stanton has refused to go negative. That's just not, he's not going to go negative. That's his whole thing. So
anyone can burn a bridge, he says.
Yeah. And so they're falling behind in the polls, and their nearest rival is Senator Lawrence Harris, played by Kevin Cooney. And yeah, Harris is being pretty negative. So Stanton decides they're going to up it a little bit. And they kind of do a...
The Schmooze for Jews.
Well, yeah, the Schmooze for Jews comes next, which is fantastic, by the way. Rob Reiner is so hilarious. But he they kind of do this sort of whisper campaign about Harris not being pro-Israel and threatening Medicaid. This is in Florida. So Stanton's on this on the radio show with Izzy Rosenblatt, Schmooze for Jews, and Harris calls in. But during the debate that Stanton, you know, wins, trips him up, unfortunately, Harris suffers a heart attack.
Hello, folks. I'm Izzy Rosenblatt, and I'm here with Schmooze for Jews. And my guest today is presidential nominee and JFK lookalike, Governor Jack Stanton.
Hi, Izzy.
Hi, Jack. Jack, when we were talking before, you were telling me that your mama liked Vegas. As a tip to our listeners, when she goes there, where does she stay? Which hotel?
Well, she's pretty loyal to the MGM Grand.
MGM Grand. Listen up, you Vegas fans. And who is her favorite act there? Is it Wayne Newton?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Everybody loves Wayne Newton. He's marvelous. He was once a guest on this show. Of course, that was many, many years ago. Now, to satisfy the curiosity of our Vegas fans, when your mother plays blackjack, where does she stand, Pat? Is it 16?
Well, she is a bit of a gambler, but so sometimes she'll go up to 17.
Oh, my. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, Governor, but I'm told that we have Senator Harris on the phone. Hello, this is indeed an honor.
Thank you.
We were just talking with Governor Stanton about how his mother loves Las Vegas. I was wondering, Senator, does your mother have a favorite vacation spot?
My mother's dead.
Oh. I'm sorry.
And Jack Stanton should be ashamed of the way he's scaring a lot of other elderly people down here.
You mean about going up to 17?
What?
I'm not following you.
He's telling people that I'm going to cut their Social Security.
Come on, Larry, it's part of your book.
Everyone knows what you're doing down here, the sleazy politics you're playing.
Is it okay if I get a word in here?
Go ahead, Governor, be my guest. What am I saying? You are my guest.
Larry, I'm looking at your campaign book here, page 18, paragraph 3. What exactly does it mean when you say you want to study a freeze of cost of living adjustments?
Well, that's only one possibility. We might want to rework how they're calculated.
Well, I can tell you that cost of living adjustments are calculated to keep up with inflation. But I guess you don't think that's such a good idea.
Now, wait a minute. I didn't say that.
Well, it's right here in your book.
I said it has to be studied. Who knows? We might even want to spend more on cost of living adjustments.
Tell me, Senator Harris, who is your favorite comedian?
What?
I'm telling the folks what my positions are. And you're the one here.
No, no, no. You're distorting my positions. This is the reason no one trusts the political process.
Well, no, you just can't defend
Not
your
position. Not when
positions.
You play these games. Ladies and gentlemen, we just can't afford to keep spending money like this.
But you just said that you might want to spend more on cost of living adjustments. Larry, I think you're confused.
No. Excuse me. But now listen. Excuse me.
What happened? Did he hang up or what?
Yes. Well, tell me, Governor, who's your favorite comedian?
They win, but they kind of lose. And then all of a sudden, Harris gets replaced by former Florida Governor Fred Picker, played by Larry Hagman. And it is, there's a whole bunch of people who they're speculating he's based on. But Larry Hagman does such a great job with this character, because the guy seems to be like a straight up guy. He hasn't been in politics for a while. He had to withdraw from his, you know, from the political life, what, in the 80s, to tend to his family. But he was a true believer in the 70s. In fact, that's who Libby was a big supporter of. That's why she went crazy, is because she was a Picker person. And when he withdrew from politics, she became despondent.
Well, and he's such a mellow kind of just non-political kind of guy. When he shows up at first, they don't think he's any kind of serious threat. But then, it doesn't take them very long to figure out that he's now got all of the oxygen in the room. Because, you know, he's like, we're not going to do this like everybody else. I'm not going to do pollsters. I'm not going to, like, everybody just needs to calm down. So he's like the anti-candidate.
Oh, yeah, which means that you can't attack him.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and they made the point, and we can't really, you know, how do we really go after somebody who isn't running? Because he hasn't really declared that he's running. And, you know, the Richard Jemmons character, that Billy Bob Thornton, is like, oh, he's running. He just hasn't said it yet. And he's just going to dink around until he can screw us.
Yeah, and the convention's coming up. You know, it's quite possible that Stanton's going to lose the whole thing. And they worked very hard to get to this point. So, in fact, they're thrilled when when Harris wins one of the first states and they get number two. Because number two is great. It's still in the race. You know, they just have to kind of keep building momentum, which is hard when Picker comes in and is like, slows down everybody's momentum. So, Henry and Libby need to poke around with Picker's past, even though Libby does not want to do it. She is not interested in bringing him down.
Well, and she and Henry have that long exposition. Well, she has that long exposition in the car where she keeps making up different, you know, she keeps making up different little aphorisms. And he's just like, Libby, if you don't stop, I'm going to kill myself.
Oh, yeah. No, the Libby and Henry team are kind of hilarious.
Yeah.
Then they interview Picker's brother-in-law, Eddie Reyes, played by the always wonderful Tony Shalhoub.
Yeah, he was really awesome in this role.
He was. I mean, for a little amount of screen time, he ate it up.
No, he had a great screen presence. I had forgotten he was in this movie.
Yeah. So he explains that, yeah, Picker's problem was his cocaine problem.
And yeah, he was too clean.
Yeah.
The problem was he really was too clean. It was terrible.
Except for his cocaine problem, which is what led to his first marriage breaking up. And then they go to interview his dealer, which is Lorenzo Delgado, played by John Vargas. And we know John Vargas from Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and Santa Barbara. also, for a limited screen presence, really gives a nice performance.
Well, he adds a fair bit of gravity to the situation.
Oh, yeah, because it turns out he's, although they don't really spell it out, but he's dying of AIDS.
Yeah.
And he's dying of AIDS because he had a lot of indiscriminate homosexual sex, including some with Picker. So now that they have this information, Henry and Libby go back to share their findings with Jack and Susan, but they had already agreed, or maybe Libby agreed for both of them, that here's the information, but you are not going to use it. We are not going to destroy this man's life. That's not what
right.
we do.
Well, that was Libby's test. She and Henry, she said, this is the test. This is how we tell if our true believerism is well placed. It's graduation day for us. We get to take all this evidence and go find out what our candidates are really all about and, what their convictions are and, if they really mean what they say, or are they just terrible people?
And Libby's still a true believer, crazy or not. So they lay it out and Libby and Jack are like, well, no, we're going to use it. We're going to leak it to the press. And Libby's like, well, you're not actually going to. And here's why. And so she reveals that, Jack tampered with the paternity test. So whether or not he's the father of the child, the fact that he submitted Uncle Charlie's blood instead proves that he at least slept with her, like he could be the father.
Yeah, he was worried that he might be, so he changed the submission of the blood test so that it would say that it wasn't him.
Which proves that he's a bad guy. And she's like, oh yeah, we'll leak this. You're not going to destroy this other guy, because I will destroy you. And it seems very serious.
Well, and that's where you see Mrs. Stanton, where where Libby makes the very pointed comment, like, to see Jack, she doesn't even care that, you may have knocked up the babysitter. Like, she's already moved on.
Oh, yeah. Which means, Hillary is nothing if not cold and calculating. I mean, Susan.
And she laughs like the Joker, by the way.
Yes. So then Henry and Libby leave. And they're pretty despondent, but as they're traveling along, Libby borrows a pen and writes something on it. It's out of the folder, and then gives it to Henry and says, here, you need to give this information, you need to deliver this back to the Stantons, because I don't have it in me to destroy the Stantons. So you give it to them. This is the evidence of the paternity test thing. So the threats from Libby are kind of empty.
Well, but she makes the point. She says, make them sweat. That's where Henry's like, make them sweat. Well, let's hold on to this for a couple of days and not let them off the hook. They need to really think about this.
Yeah. And Libby's like, no. So, Henry invites Libby up and Libby's like, no, I'm fine. I'll drive myself home. And later that night or early in the morning, Henry wakes up to police cars and finds that Libby has committed suicide.
Yeah, and in kind of an odd, jarring way he wakes up, though, he already knows something's up, which is, I'm not sure, because he immediately, once he heard the sirens, knew what was up.
Yeah, well, and this is weighing heavily on him.
ESP.
He's a true believer also. So the fact that Libby is kind of destroyed by the feet of clay of her heroes, both of her heroes, because Picker has feet of clay, and obviously Jack and Susan have feet of clay.
Yeah.
So Henry delivers the information, although off screen, Henry delivers the information to Stanton. And instead of leaking it to the press, Stanton takes it personally to Picker and gives it to him and apologizes for seeking it out. And this is where Larry Hagman really shines. I mean, he just admits to this whole thing and he's just, he's just super sad because he knows that even though Jack is giving this information, the fact that Libby could find it out means that somebody's going to find it out sooner or later. So he's fucked. He's absolutely fucked. He's got to figure out how to tell his children, his boys who are in college.
Yeah, no, Larry Hagman's performance, I mean, he was his amazing. It was probably, it was an amazing performance from him. He was believable.
Well, and coming right after, because you're right, the beginning of it is kind of, fun. And then you have the Libby speech when they find, you have the speech from Tony Shalhoub, which leads the speech from John Vargas, which is like sort of a downer. And then you have the conversation between Libby and Jack and Susan, which is kind of drama. No. And then Libby kills herself. And then you have this.
Well, you have Libby and Henry's exchange in the truck.
True.
Where she talks about, you know, how she's the moon.
Yeah.
You know, and she only exists when she's reflected. You know, she only exists when the sun shines on her.
Yeah, and so that's all very dramatic. And then Larry Hagman's performance is really dramatic. And then we have the conversation as Henry, who is completely disgusted at this point. Henry is going to quit this campaign. And as he and Jack are walking out of the Picker estate back to their car, and they see in the distance that there are reporters around their car. And Jack is like, okay, come on, you know, let's go talk to him. And Henry's like, no, I'm quitting. This is horrible. You know, you were not the person I thought you were. And that's where, you know, John Travolta does a good job.
Governor, I'm resigning from the campaign.
I don't accept your resignation.
Look, I just don't feel comfortable about this anymore.
About what?
This line of work.
Well, I spoke to Richard. He's back on board. I'm putting him in charge, campaign manager. Probably in the office right now. I'm bringing Daisy back, too, if she'll come.
That's not what this is about.
Then what is it?
Libby.
Ah.
Libby's test. You flunked it.
Yeah, but just now I passed it, so which grade do I get, Henry? The high or the low?
If she hadn't died...
If she hadn't died, I'd have leaked the file, the summon, and I'd have felt bad about it. But you know what? I would have been wrong not to do it. What I did now, I did for Libby. But it wasn't right. Picker hadn't quit it, won the nomination, gone down and taken the party with him. It was only a question of when.
And how, and who pushed him off the cliff when he was
That's
falling.
That's right, but those are fine points, Henry. Those are how many angels can you fit on the head of a pin points? This is hardball. Now, you telling me that you just discovered that and you don't have the stomach for it? I know you better than that. We spent too much time together. This is it, Henry. This is the price you pay to lead. You don't think that Abraham Lincoln was a whore before he was a president? He had to tell his little stories and smile his shit-eating backcountry grin. And he did it just so that he would one day have the opportunity to stand in front of the nation and appeal to the better angels of our nature. And that's where the bullshit stops. That's what it's all about, so we have the opportunity to make the most of it, to do it the right way. You know as well as I do, there are plenty of people playing this game that don't think that way. They're willing to sell their souls, crawl through sewers, lie to people, divide them, play on the worst fears for nothing. Just for the prize.
I don't care. I'm sorry. But I'm not comparing the players. I don't like the game. I want to work for something small. Voter registration.
And after everyone's registered, who will they vote for? In the end, Henry, who can do this better than me? Think about it. Is there anyone else out there with a chance to actually win this election who'd do more for the people than I would? Who'd even think about the folks I care about?
Oh, shit.
Is that them so quick?
That damn driver, I knew it.
All right. We'll go talk to them together. Come on. Don't shake your head, Henry. We worked so hard together to get here. And it's there for us now, right there. We can do incredible things. We can change this whole country. I'm gonna win this thing. And when I do, we're gonna make history. Look me in the eye and tell me it's not gonna happen. Look me in the eye, Henry, and tell me you don't wanna be a part of it. Jesus, Henry. You want me to get down on my knees? I can't do it without you. Don't leave me now. You're still with me, aren't you? Say you are. Say it. Say it. Come on, Henry. This is ridiculous. You gotta be with me.
I think this is the part of the movie that kind of depressed me, because Stanton gives this speech that begs Henry to reconsider, telling him that, look, they can make history. Like, who is going to change the lives of these people? Which of the other candidates? Only he's going to make the difference. And sure, he's not a perfect person, but you don't need the perfect people. You need somebody who cares. So you got to be with me. And, you know, Henry has already believed this guy's bullshit before, So he doesn't really want to believe it. And yet, what are the alternatives, you know? So you have this speech where it's unclear whether Henry is going to quit or not. And then you have a great transition to the inaugural ball where President Stanton is dancing happily with the First Lady Susan. And as he goes down the line to shake the hands of all his campaign staff, who's last in the line, the people he shakes hands with? It's Henry. He's still there and seems to be happy to be there. So my question for you is, what do you think about the end of the movie?
Well, this movie's hard to pull apart from the parallels in the Clinton campaign. So from a purely movie standpoint, the downer of the end of it really kind of doesn't match with the rest of the movie tone-wise. So it makes me wonder if they had a very different kind of upbeat comedic ending that didn't test well and they scrapped it. Because the end of the movie doesn't have the same kind of atmosphere that the rest of the movie does. And the way it ends is just so abrupt. So it's like there was more to it. And even though I have the DVD, I own it on a DVD, there was no deleted scenes that were included. So I don't know what didn't make the movie. I suspect there was more substance somewhere that there's more story somewhere that had the governor helping convince Henry that there was some redemption to get Henry to come back, because I don't see that having happened. You know, you jump past all of that at the point where they're standing at Picker's gate and the pressure there. So you get from C to Z, you miss all the stuff between. And I think there's some story there that we missed.
Well, I don't know about that, because the way I interpret that last speech that Stanton makes to Henry is that Henry may be Henry's a true believer, so he's already a little bit susceptible to it. But Stanton is a snake. Stanton is hypnotizing Henry. You know, he's going.
Oh, you think he's trying to sell Henry the snake oil?
He is a snake. He is hypnotizing Henry, and he's going to eat him alive.
I see.
He's selling snake oil, but he's selling it in the way he always has, using all those things to tug at your heartstrings. He's tugging at Henry's heartstrings specifically and saying, look, you know I'm not perfect. I know I'm not perfect, but I'm the best man for this job, and you know that too. And so together, you can make me be a better person. He's basically flattering Henry into staying on board by saying, hey,
well,
I need you because you're the true believer that makes me a better person.
Yeah, you're the kind of the moral compass that I need that I don't have around me.
Yeah, yeah. If you're not with me, then you can't help make the world a better place, because I'm going to be in a position to do so.
Yeah, and I may not have passed the test last night or last week, but I passed the test, Libby's test now.
Yeah,
exactly. So you have to give me credit for that.
Yeah, I did the right thing now.
So even though I may not have, even though I may have been a dick last week, I still came honest. I came about.
And so whatever it is that gives him the magic, and it is, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, Bill Clinton is really charismatic, in a way that George H.W. Bush was not, but in a way that I think George W. Bush was kind of, I mean, George W. Bush was kind of folksy, which endeared him to people.
Yeah.
And Barack Obama is really, really charismatic. He's not the folksy Bill Clinton. He's not the folksy George W. Bush. He's more of the professorial type. But he comes off as being cool and smart. And that's worth something.
He's very suave.
Yeah. Yeah, he's the anti-Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump makes a lot of noise and says a lot of those bumper sticker things that people want to hear. So that makes him attractive as a speaker. But I mean, part of being a politician is selling stuff, is to be a salesman. And Hillary Clinton is sometimes a really good salesperson and sometimes not.
Yeah.
So, and maybe it's a little bit of a woman thing. Maybe, I mean, obviously people treat her differently because she's a woman. But, and whether that's fair or not is a whole different issue. But, well, that's like Sarah Palin. Bless her pointy little head. Sarah Palin was all style and no substance. And it works. That kind of stuff works. That's what Donald Trump is right now. He's all style too. He has no real solutions. He says, look, I can build a fence across the whole thing because I've built a 90-story building. It's like, yeah, there's no plans there. It's all just talk. Make America work. That's great. Wonderful. Great. Good thing, you know. But anyway.
I just watched Rachel Maddow from Friday that I recorded on my DVR because I am the crazy left-wing liberal guy that records Rachel Maddow and watches her later. But Andrea Mitchell interviewed Hillary Clinton in a one-on-one. I don't know how long the interview really was, but Rachel Maddow discussed it for most of the hour. And it was interesting to listen to her because Andrea Mitchell didn't pull any punches and she has a long history with Hillary Clinton. So it was interesting to listen to the dynamic of the two of them go back and forth. But Hillary still posturing, and she, you know, it's clear that she says, you know, people comment that she's choosing her words too carefully. And Hillary's response was, well, as president of the United States, you have to choose your words carefully because your words have impact sometimes in ways you don't understand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, like, for instance, when George Bush referred to the Gulf War as a crusade, you can't use that. You can't call it a crusade if you're a Christian president going after Muslim people.
Yeah. You think that's a problem?
Yeah, it's a problem. Somebody should have decided that was a bad word to use. But and yet you want people to speak from the heart. You know, speak like contemporaneously, off the cuff. But as it turns out, you kind of don't, you know? You want somebody who's going to think before they speak. And I don't know. It's what I put in my notes were, is it just all fucked? Are there no angels? Is it all a ruthless, dirty game where all we can hope for is that the person who cheats his way to the top still has some integrity left to do some good? And the other thought I had is, how many flaws do you ignore and still be able to support and work for somebody who you think will do the right thing when they get the job?
Well, I think you, especially in this instance, I think it matters greatly. You know, you have to balance the greater good and the lesser of the two evils. Because, you know, when I vote, this is now turning into politics talk, but.
Well, we're talking about politics movies, so that's kind of comes with the territory.
Right. No, I understand. And I'm listening to the next Rob Lowe book, which is biography-ish. And he talks about his support of Arnold Schwarzenegger as a candidate. Even though prior to Arnold Schwarzenegger being a candidate, you know, Rob Lowe was this big bleeding heart Democrat supporter. And he said, well, I'm putting my money where my mouth is. Now I'm independent and I'm not voting on party lines because I don't think there's a party that actually has the correct inclusion. I vote for the person who I think is going to do the best job. And sometimes that's going to be an independent. Sometimes it's going to be a Democrat. It might be a Republican, but not, hasn't happened yet. And I kind of, that's kind of my philosophy is I vote for who I think is going to do the best job, but you have to balance, you know, well, who is your vote going to be most effective for? Because you can vote for Ben Carson if you think he's a great guy, but he's not going to win. So is that a good vote or is that a bad vote? Well, it's your voice, sure. But would that vote be better served supporting somebody else who might actually win who you want to win and then kind of better that? So, you know, you're kind of really, really splitting hairs at that point.
Well, and I've spent a lot of my adult life. Well, obviously I couldn't vote before as an adult, but I spent a lot of my up until recently. I mean, I voted for Barack Obama, but mostly I voted against people, you know. I mean, in our state where until recently there wasn't any real choice because the candidates who had the, you know, who had been in the job forever were always going to win. There was no upset in our local, national elections, but for, you know, the House of Representatives, we get one. And during my, not my whole life, but certainly my adult life, it's only been one person. And
well, I mean, and you know, I remember growing up in junior high and high school. And you could name your representatives and senators because it was Murkowski and Young and Stevens.
And it had always been so. And
wasn't ever going to change.
Exactly. Yeah.
And Tom Murkowski, in some strange addled brain decision, decided to run for governor, which, like, you had a great gig. Why did you want to F that up?
Well, you know, maybe it wasn't as great a gig as, you know, and again, it's, you know, it's your legacy, right? Turns out he wasn't a great governor.
Yeah, I was going to say, except he replaced his long legacy with, like, a one-term governorship that was lackluster.
Yeah, well.
Followed by governor's half-term.
Yeah, see, voting against people is a problem, because then you really are just getting the least bad guy in office. You know, you're just...
Yeah, I mean, you're getting the remainder.
Yeah, it's weird. Because now the way campaigns are set up, it's all just, you know, sound bites. And yeah. So, you know, if you could do a lot of work, nobody does. But
you need two or three good sound bites and you're done.
Yeah. And that's really all. And you just need to have something to smear your rival with.
Not to fall off the stage.
Yeah, and whoever, you know, at the end of the campaign on election night, you figure out which candidate stinks the least and you vote for him or her. And that's kind of depressing, you know? And the fact that it's all this money stuff, and I don't know. Perhaps I'm just in a negative, lots of systems are failing. And like the healthcare system is still tremendously fucked up, and the whole legislative process is ground to a halt. So, like, what do we do? And again, it kind of runs down to, you know, do you hold your nose and vote for somebody who you think is going to govern in your interest, even though that person may be seriously flawed? I don't know. It's weird. It made me ponder those sort of questions in a way that the movie Dave did not. Dave was a fun, happy movie.
Yeah.
And this was fun in the fact that, you know, I loved the dialogue was really crisp. I mean, it's not quite Sorkin, but it's pretty fun. And
it was pretty Sorkin-esque, though.
Yeah. And, you know, Allison Janney out of the get-go was great. You know, except for Emma Thompson's accent, she did fine. John Travolta did great. Billy Bob Thornton always does a good job, even though he's kind of skeezy. Maura Tierney is always fun to see and really good. Kathy Bates, you know, deserved her Academy Award nomination. And Larry Hagman was just freaking brilliant. And even though I haven't seen Adrian Lester, the Henry Burton actor, in any or anything else I can remember, or I don't remember seeing him, he does a good job. You know, he plays convicted really well. Or, sorry, he plays conflicted very well. So, I'm glad we talked about it, but I guess I can't say at the very end of the movie, it left me with lots of, like, depressing thoughts rather than uplifting thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, as a whole, the movie didn't leave you on a high note.
Not at all. Because that smile that Henry gives at the end, I mean, I don't know. I just think maybe he got fooled.
Duped.
Yeah. And yet, what was he going to do? Go back to work for the, he wasn't working for the paper that his girlfriend was, right? He was working some sort of low-level campaign staff with somebody else.
He was working for a different campaign.
Right? Yeah. So...
But that's the thing. If you have the ability to work with the leader of the free world, as they call it, which is debatable, but you know, if you were put in a position where you can have the ear of the president and have influence of some kind, which Henry obviously did, because the governor was, you know, was trying to convince him not to go anywhere. If you have that kind of in to the White House, you can do so much better from inside the White House than you can from outside of it.
Oh, and
so,
you know,
you're much more easily able to take an active role when you have the weight and force of the White House behind you rather than against you, or, you know, in communion with, as opposed, you know, if Henry's in the White House in some capacity, which you would believe, you know, damn well, they would give him some kind of position because they would want to keep him close and happy. Because he knows all the dirt, first of all, but second of all, because he can get stuff done. He's, you know, he's who you want And because he's a true believer, he has the fervor, and he's, you know, you're not going to have to motivate him. He's going to be pretty self-motivated. So,
well, and that's why The West Wing was so successful as a series, because it gave you, you know, the top level politics of the president, you know, whether or not you believe that President Bartlet was a good president. You got to see like all of the sausage making behind the scenes, and the fact that his staff were, some of them were really ruthless and some of them were kind of naive, but all of them were true believers. They all had that, you know, they all wanted to make a positive difference. And that's something that you want. I mean, that's the kind of thing I want to believe is happening.
Well, and I mean, naive or not, I have to believe that if you're working at the White House, you have to believe you're doing something good, because you wouldn't just be doing it to do it, because there's no money in it.
Well,
there's power perhaps in small instances, but you know, if you're a mid-level to low-level staffer at the White House, you're not making any money.
No, I'm sure you're making connections though. They will make you money in the future if that's what you want to do. But yeah,
that currency is very easily stolen and sometimes easily bankrupted.
Well, yeah, but I guess you're right. I mean, if you believe you're doing the right thing, and that does have value.
Yeah, I mean, you have to. How comfortable are you, and how much of your soul are you willing to give up? And I think that's what the. I think that's the moral tale you get with Henry how much of Henry's soul has Henry sold to make himself at peace with this?
Because he's sold some. I think that's the part that bummed me
absolutely.
Out. Is that he did sell something. He gave something up. And the question is, was it worth it? And hopefully it was.
Well, and that's the other half of the story that we don't get. We don't know.
Well, he became the anchor on ABC News, right? Or one of the head people on ABC News. George Stephanopoulos?
Yeah, he had his own show, I think.
Yeah. No, he's a big thing in ABC News, I'm pretty sure, still today. I'm sure, I mean, the movie itself says this is a work of fiction. But it's...
Loosely.
Yeah, it's loosely based on real character, so. Anyway. Yeah, so I thought it was a fun trip back in time.
Have you seen the movie The War Room?
I have a long time ago. I kind of want to see it again.
I own it. It's great.
That's a documentary... That introduces you to James Carville and George
Stephanopoulos.
Yeah. And where you actually see these little things come up. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts, dial it already.